In turn, all these poor soldiers had each been declared dead. And Willie had not. She had told her mammy Isabel how that gave her hope. But Isabel had travelled a long, hard road in life. She held her youngest daughter in her arms and told Lizzie to put aside hope, to give her attention to practical things, her new bairn, her wee job, and feeding the pair of them. "If you hope," said Isabel, "you also mope." None of that mattered now. Willie Campbell was home, and Lizzie was moving around the room before she knew what she was moving for. There were happy voices in the close. She could hear them sing his name, and she knew they would be coming for him soon. She gathered Agnes into her arms and took her to the drying cupboard. She parted a stack of towels and took out a hidden sewing tin. She opened it quietly, and the air was thick with the sweet smell of buttery Madeira cake. The shelf also held a greasy ham hock, and Lizzie ripped a hunk from the bone. She put the whole Madeira tin on Agnes's lap, and into each hand slid a hunk of greasy flesh. "Mammy needs you to stay in here a while." She closed the door gently on her daughter. They would be coming for him. Lizzie quickly stepped out of her underwear. She didn't kiss him. She still had not thrown her arms around him. None of that would be enough to fill the absence she had felt. She doubled herself over the back of the wooden armchair and gripped the turned armrests for support. She felt him appear behind her. His presence was faint at first, like he was merely following her on the street. But then he touched her. He kissed the back of her neck, and she felt him push roughly inside. She watched his brown hands as his strange fingers curled around her pale forearms. He pushed into her slowly, and then he went faster. And soon he folded onto her, covering her as if he were a blanket, as if they were one. They would be coming for him. He didn't smell as she remembered. There was an overripe orange tang to his hair, and his breath, though sweet, smelt more like molasses than she liked. Lizzie turned her neck to look back at him. His eyes were open and concentrating on her, and she was sure it was him. That green and copper colour, the colour of a golden sun bursting through thick green beech leaves, was still the same. Once, long before Agnes, Willie had taken her on three separate buses and up to the Kelvin Grove Hall. She had never been inside such a fine building before, and she was shy to follow him through its grand halls. She felt her shoes were too loud, too squeaky, and the hem of her good dress hung too long out of the bottom of her coat. Willie hadn't minded. With his thick arms, he separated the crowds for her. He acted like he had the same right to be there as any doctor from the Byers Road. Only later did he confess to her that he knew of this grand place just because he had repaired the tiles on its roof. It had been a rare afternoon. At the top of the sandstone staircase, there had been a painting on exhibition. A beautiful oil painting of a stand of beech trees sat at the side of a lazy river. The autumn wildflowers still golden and bracken-coloured on its bank. Willie had been smiling at her then, and she had forgotten all about her chapel dress. His eyes were speckled the same colours as the painting, the same faded green colour of uncollected hay and deep umber of a red deer. Now, as she searched these eyes for the man she loved, she knew the green of the painting was the same, even if the frame they sat in was something different. There was a faint noise. She had forgotten. How could she have forgotten when she had lost so much sleep worrying over it? Willie stopped pushing into her. He straightened and was staring into the corner as if he was seeing something approaching in the distance, something he didn't like the look of. Lizzie felt him slip out of her. He tidied himself back inside his uniform and was moving towards the far corner. He was tiptoeing with his palms wide open, as if the thing hiding there might spook and try to rush past him. The infant cried out again. He was gurning as Willie pulled back the tented curtain of the crib. She would never forget that look on his face. He was staring at her over the wide bone of his shoulder when the front door finally gave. Nobody bothered to knock, and there were footsteps and cheering as the union men and their wives spilt in with plates of sandwiches and half bottles of McKinley's. She had only enough time to let go of the arms of the chair and straighten herself before the first cans of Sweetheart Stout were burst. As he made a pantomime of hugging his pals, his green and amber eyes never left her face. All she could do was mouth across the happy crowd to him. "I'm so sorry." Later, they had pulled the heavy curtain across and climbed into the recessed bed before the last well-wishers had left. He said he was tired, but Lizzie could feel the heat of the drink radiate off him as he lay awake beside her. She wondered if her shame burned outwardly in the same way. They didn't talk. They lay there not touching, and he felt farther away from her now than he ever had in Egypt. When she woke in the morning, he was already dressed in his good wool suit. The trousers were wide-looking now, a little old-fashioned, and she could see that the jacket hung on him more loosely than it had in the past. He had found the secret tins of Spam and hidden ham hock and the last of the Madeira cake that the grocer had given her. He was trying to feed his daughter a mouthful of fried Spam, and each time she refused, he would laugh and spoil her with a bite of Madeira. She didn't like to see him with that dirty food. She could imagine Mr. Kilfeather, the bow-legged greengrocer, but she could not rightly remember how it had all started. It had all been so insidious. Had it just been an extra handful of eggs? A little more than the ration book would give? Had it been the spare arse end of a loaf? How could she tell Willie any of it? The infant, this other little Kilfeather boy, was gently cooing to itself in the corner. Willie's back was to it, like he couldn't hear it. As she stepped from behind the curtain, Willie rose without looking at her. He rebuttoned his jacket and kissed Agnes goodbye. Then he removed the bundled bag of clean sheets from the old pram. Lizzie was watching him as he lifted the little boy from his crib. The baby's pink arms reached out to him, like it knew and trusted the deep well of goodness from which Willie Campbell had sprung. Lizzie watched Willie place the baby in the proud carriage and tuck the knitted blanket tenderly under his chin. He turned for the door. Something made her step forward. She put her hand on the carriage handle. "Where are you going?"
"Out."
"Will you be back?"
"Of course."
He sounded surprised at the question. She felt like if she cried, she would never stop. Lizzie let go of the handle.
"I'm so sorry,"
she whispered.
"I got bits of meat. We ate well. I just didn't know if you would ever come home."
"I know," was all he said. She was pleading now.
"When I found out, I took every ascot powder I could get. Great big handfuls of it. It was just too late."
"I don't need to know, Lizzie." He took her face in his hands and kissed her then. It was the first kiss she had been given since he had kissed her at St. Enoch's on the day he left. She had never let Mr. Kilfeather kiss her. She felt she had to tell him that. He said,
"I'm sorry I was away so long."
Then Willie took the pram and the strange baby and went out into the mild spring morning. It was the longest day she had ever known. Willie was back before the street lamps were lit. Lizzie had been at the window all day, and she could hear him whistling all the way down Saracen Street. Mrs. Devlin told her later that he had given her a fright, because at first she had thought it was one of yon Indian fellows, seeing how dark and golden he was. Then, she said, he had danced up the stairs, singing and swinging on the banister like he was Fred Astaire himself. When he came in the door, there was no pram, there was no blanket, there was no strange little boy. He gathered his girls into his arms, and Lizzie could smell the cold, fresh air in him, like faraway open fields. Willie ate his dinner with an appetite, two big bowls of pea soup thickened with cream and salty with stripped mutton. Lizzie couldn't tell him where it had all come from, how it had been paid for, and she was relieved that he didn't ask. That night, as she curried into him behind the curtain, she stroked the thick hair in his arm. She turned to him and asked where the baby boy was. Willie pulled her closer to him and looked at her with those speckled green eyes, and all he said was, "What baby?" Chapter 16. Agnes thought about what her mother had told her. She thought about it constantly in the days leading up to her father's death. The lung cancer eventually took him. He rattled all the way to the end. They buried Willie Campbell on a damp day in March, on a gentle slope at the back of Lambhill Cemetery. On the days she was sober, Agnes cried for her father. Then she cried for herself, jealous that Shug had never loved her the way Willie had loved Lizzie. When she was in the drink, she phoned her mother and railed at the old woman for having spoilt her memories of her father. "What man takes a baby and just makes it go away?" Then, within a month of her father's death, her mother died, and there was no one left to scream at anymore. Elizabeth Catherine Campbell had died in her slippered feet. By the time Agnes had pleaded with a Glasgow taxi rank to drive all the way to Pithead and take her to the hospital, Lizzie had been with the Angels for an hour and a half. Agnes, in her state of distress, had walked out and down the centre of the lonely pit road to meet the taxi. When she finally saw the headlights, she threw herself prostrate into the dust. When she arrived at the hospital, the police had told Agnes that the bus driver was devastated.
"He's a good man," they said, "with many years of clean devoted service to the corporation."
It was just he never expected the old woman to step backwards off the curb. He never meant to kill her, but in stepping backwards, she must have been determined to kill herself. That's what they said. Under the shaded brims of their police hats, Agnes knew the constables were running their eyes the drunken length of her, as though this ruin of a woman would drive any mother to the same. Their cold eyes and their warm words did not match.
"It happened often enough," they said then,
as though Lizzie had chosen this cowardly way to end things. Her mammy would never. She was a good Catholic. Agnes knew better. Later that week, when the undertakers finally released Lizzie, Agnes set the body up for a viewing in her mother's bedroom. Leek helped her lift the double bed and lean it against the wall to make way for the trestles and the small coffin. Their mattress lay propped there, and she knew it would never come down again. From the linen closet, she took a wide sheet and draped it over the bulk of the mattress like it was a ghost of good memories, now dead. She hadn't yet paid her father a month's mind, and already here she was, stood at the foot of her dead mother. Her bones cried out for drink. Agnes sat alone at the side of Lizzie's open coffin. She covered her hair in the most sombre headscarf she owned and wore the same black knitted dress for the second time that month. The Sighthill flat held no good memories for her now. First it had been her daddy, and now it was her mammy. She laid no cardboard over the carpet this time. Let the mourners ruin it. Lizzie looked tiny in the coffin. The undertaker had applied thick makeup to the gouges on her forehead and hidden her mangled hands under the band of silk trimming cloth. Agnes arranged her Bible and coiled her medallion of St. Jude on top of the silk. She was done with all that. Agnes had asked that Lizzie be dressed in her olive Sunday suit and that the roots be dyed out of her hair. The undertaker had asked her to bring a hat to cover some damage to her mother's head, and she gave him a photo that showed how her hair should be set into tight rosette curls and how it should frame her face on the sides. The man did his best to return her to a look of peace, but there was a thick waxiness to her face that denied Lizzie her true likeness. There was no happy tint to her cheeks, no light rose flare at the end of her small nose. Agnes kissed her then. She cried for her forgiveness. When she ran dry, she sat upright again and listened to the hum of the television in the flat next door. She took off her last pair of unpawned earrings and gently inserted them into her mother's lobes.
I know they don't match.
She pulled a tight curl over the left one.
At least Daddy will have a good laugh when he sees you.
Her hands turned Lizzie's good brooch upright, the beautiful tin pressing of the Virgin and Child that Nan Flanagan had brought back specially from Lourdes.
Poor Nan. She should have kept a closer eye on you,
she exhaled.
Why did you have to do such a stupid thing?
Agnes spat in a piece of balled up toilet paper and wiped at the bone of her mother's cheeks. The heavy paint barely shifted.
I was going to make tin salmon sandwiches instead of cheese this time. Is that all right? I didn't like the way the edges of Daddy's pieces went hard as they sat out all day. I could see those ingrates roll their eyes. I saw that bism Anna O'Hanna and her curled lip. I even heard Dolly say to her John, all they people in from Donegal, no even a slice of meat for the bread.
Agnes pushed out her bright lipstick and drew it across her mother's thin lips. Rubbing a little on her thumb, she smoothed it into her gaunt cheeks as rouge. She wanted to straighten the emerald green cloche, but was afraid to touch the back of Lizzie's head. So instead, she licked gently at the auburn curls on her crown with the end of a pick comb.
There. You look better for a little life in your cheeks.
The words stuck in her throat. Agnes stayed by her mother's side for the night. In the damp of the April morning, they laid Lizzie's coffin in the open space above Willie. The ground was sodden. The grave needed to be pumped out of water before they lowered her in on top of her husband. After the burial, Agnes wrapped sandwiches in paper towels and sent Shuggy three times around the room, until black handbags were bursting and fragrant with hot salmon and butter. Even when people turned the boy away, Agnes sent him back around and around with pretty plates heavy with thick meat. It was dark when they got home from the reception. The miners' women were still leaning on sagging gates, taking advantage of the break in the spitting rain. She was sober, for fear her mother had been watching. But now, as she stood over Leek, she let the amber sweetness of special brew soak her heart. Agnes stood over him as he opened his sketchbook. From an envelope at the back, he unfolded a long piece of paper with what seemed like an endless amount of numbers on it. Sleeked and embarrassed, he covered the rotary from her eyes and slowly dialed the long African number. Here it was then, the number that Catherine never wanted her to have. It was the loneliest feeling. She tried to listen for as much information as she could glean, but he was laconic with his words. She strained to hear Catherine's voice. From the damp hallway in Pethead, it sounded to Agnes like there were beautiful canary birds in the very air. She wanted to imagine Catherine surrounded with lush carpets of tropical flowers, with pretty names she might never learn, from books she would never read. In her heart, she hoped her daughter was happy. She hoped Catherine would call out to her, that Leek would pass the telephone and she could tell her for herself how much she wanted her home.
"Catherine, it's me. It's Leek," he said. "I'm sorry. It's Mammy's phone." "Yes. She's here, actually. She's standing right next to me."
He looked Agnes up and down suspiciously. There was a pause. Agnes could hear Catherine raise her voice in agitation.
"Don't worry, I never.
I promise you I wouldn't."
"Do you like South Africa?"
There was a pause.
"Oh, he's fine.
Nearly died up the pit, but he's fine.
Still a bit funny.
You know, funny, funny."
He held his wrist out and lisped into the phone.
"Gerald Fitzpatrick and Patrick Fitzgerald, like..."
There was laughter on the other end. Agnes prodded him.
"Right, anyway, Catherine, is Donald there?" "No, I wasn't checking. It's just... I've got some bad news. It's just, well... Granny is dead."
There was another long pause. Agnes mimed.
"Is she crying?"
Leek waved her away. "Last week, she was hit by a corpy bus. It was fast. Her mind was going."
"Well, fine."
"No. Look, I didn't know how to say, but Granda's dead too." "That's no joke, I swear. We didn't want to upset you."
3 weeks or so."
He started to talk through gritted teeth. "Well, it was my decision not to tell you, actually. That's the thing about being left behind and all the fucking shite you get to make all the shitty decisions." There was a long pause. Agnes thought she could hear Catherine cry or apologise or both.
"So you're coming home then?"
"Ah. Ah. Okay. Ah.
Fine.
Well, congratulations, I suppose."
Agnes mimed.
"Is she asking for me?"
And tried not to look too desperate. Leek sighed.
"Look, Calf, do you want to speak to Mammy?"
"Sober, mostly.
Sad, I suppose."
"Okay, I will. Okay. No, I understand. Suit yourself. Thanks."
With that, he hung up the phone. Agnes's hands were out in front of her. She hadn't realised she had been grabbing until the line went dead. Leek just shrugged and spoke mostly into the carpet. She was too upset to talk. He rubbed at his sore jaw.
"They had South African Boer Wars for dinner. On a stick with bits of fruit. How boggin' is that?"
Chapter 17. Her body hung off the side of the bed, and by the odd angle, Shuggy could tell the drink had spun her all night like a Catherine wheel. He turned her head to the side to stop her choking on a rising bulk. Then he placed the mop bucket near the bed and gently unzipped the back of her cream dress and loosened the clasp on her bra. He would have taken off her shoes, but she wasn't wearing any, and her legs were white and stark-looking without the usual black stockings. There were new bruises on her pale thighs. Shuggy arranged 3 tea mugs, one with tap water to dry the cracks in her throat, one with milk to line her sour stomach, and the third with a mixture of the flat leftovers of special brew and stout that he had gathered from around the house and froth together with a fork. He knew this was the one she would reach for first, the one that would stop the crying in her bones. He leaned over her and listened to her breathing. Her breath was stale with cigarettes and sleep, and so he went to the kitchen and filled a fourth mug with bleach for her teeth. He tore a page from his Pulps of the Empire homework and wrote in soft pencil, "Danger, teeth cleaner, do not drink, don't even sip by accident." He heard the front door close gently. Leek would be late for work again. He was always reluctant to leave the protective cocoon of his bed. Under the covers, his day still had an unspoilt quality to it. Shuggy peered through the crack in the curtains and watched his brother's sloped shoulders inch along the road. The first of the miners' children started milling towards the school. The boys who arrived early to play football on the concrete playground were the same ones who made rings around him and shoved him when they got bored. Shuggy found her blue biro and went through his homework jotters like a bookkeeper, adding her name in a flourish. Mrs. Bain. It looked odd now. The clock radio was still flashing plenty of time till he could slip in unnoticed to morning mass. So he turned back around on the stool, clasped his hands, and waited patiently. The dresser was neat and orderly, as she liked it. When she didn't have the shakes, she would empty the little jewellery box and make sure she wiped each piece, regardless of its worth. Sometimes she lay all the trinkets out on the dresser table and they played jewellery shop. She would let him make up new combinations for her, lay out selections of earrings with complimentary necklaces. It had been easier before she had pawned the loveliest things. He watched her reflection in the mirror. Her sleeping back heaved up and down. Shuggy uncapped a bottle of mascara and rubbed the black ink into the grey cracks in his school shoes. Then he took the wand and drew it under his eyelashes. The fine lashes stood out beautifully from his face. Agnes rose from the bed like a fairground skeleton. He tried to push the brush back into the tube, but it wouldn't go, and so he slyly slid the mascara down the back of the dresser. But Agnes wasn't looking at him. The ebbing drink had made her bounce to her feet, and she was standing stock still at the side of the bed with one breast half hanging out of the black bra, which itself was hanging out of yesterday's clothes. Then she sank to the side of the bed, like she was kneeling for bedtime prayers. Her boy must have left for school. She knew he had been standing there watchful as a trapped ghost, but when she opened her eyes, he was gone. Lifting herself, she sat on the edge of the bed, the pail of water between her knees, and tried to quiet the pulse that was beating in her flushed face. The boak rose in her chest, and she strained over the bucket, arching her spine like a choking cat. She pulled the thread of memory tentatively towards herself and began gently looking at all the pictures her mind had tied to it. She saw the chair, the clock, and the empty house. She saw herself walking from the kitchen to the living room to the kitchen again, and then on her knees scraping dust from the skirting board with her fingernail. She saw the clock again, and then the lights of the scheme came on. The curtains were undrawn, and the boy home from school. Beyond that, her mind jumped like washing flapping on the line. There was a telephone and a taxi. There was the bingo and sitting alone. There was drink and drink and no win and drink and no win and the woman next door asking if she was okay and Agnes asking her if she had any wains and the woman saying no and turning away. There was a taxi home, not with Shug, and stopping at the dark mouth of the closed pit. She could almost see the taxi driver's face. And then she was screaming and choking on his aftershave. And then there was only panic. The bulk rose. It came out in a violent red-faced torrent. Spittle covered her hand, the side of the bed, and the black leather bag on the floor. Holding the sticky hand off the edge of the bed, she lay back on the pillow and pulled in gasping breaths like she was drowning. Timidly and tenderly, she slid her dry hand across the sheets and down between her legs. She pressed lightly on herself and felt the new soreness there. Then she was sick again. It was a while before she could summon up enough strength to sit up. How badly she wanted a scalding bath, but a half-empty meter meant the bathwater was only tepid. There in the shallows, she could see the red bruises on the insides of her thighs and the black pancake-sized welts that looked as though the flesh was dying underneath the cream of her skin. The water soon chilled, and she was shivering as she dried herself and put on a clean jumper. It was all she could manage to put hairspray through her hair and some blue powder on her eyes. And then she sat down in the armchair, frozen as a regal waxwork. She still didn't move when there was a light, cheerful knock at the door and the sound of long nails clawing a desperate greeting.
Agnes! Agnes! It's only me!
Jinty McGlinchey was already standing by her chair by the time she asked,
Can I come in?
She looked down at the frozen woman and sucked in through her teeth with a squeaky laugh.
Aw, hen, you look like you've taken a good soaking. I have been in there, I can tell you.
Of all the Pitt cousins, she was the only one who smelled of heavy night cream and Elizabeth Arden perfume. She donned a knotted headscarf in the sun and liked flat, comfortable shoes for her child-sized feet. Jinty wore a St. Christopher medal, and she always swore in the Bible when she was judging you. If the drink made Agnes melancholy and regretful, then it made Jinty sharp and needling. She liked to sit and put the world to right, telling people where they went wrong. Two lagers down, and her little eyes would narrow like those of a fussy judge in a jam-making competition. She was a shrew, and it was said she had been papped from every house in the scheme. Jinty was shaking her head pitifully at Agnes.
Shall I put on a wee bit of dry toast?
She was taking off the floral headscarf. Agnes nodded in silence, the edges of her mouth unable to hold a polite smile for long. Jinty took herself into the kitchen, and although the bread was laid out next to the toaster, Agnes could hear her nosing into every cabinet looking for drink. When she couldn't see the top shelves, she would jump, jump, jump like a giddy little dog, her flat sandals slapping on the hard linoleum. After some time, Jinty came back with a single piece of hard brown toast.
Was it a bad night, hen?
She asked, in her high, childlike voice, her eyes already scanning the room.
Yes. Aye, well, hen, I can't stop long. I can't stop long. I just came round for a drop of tea. Things to do, you see.
She took off her coat and sat down expectantly. Agnes tried to set the plate at the side of her chair, but her hand shook and the dry toast fell to the floor.
Dear, 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 look at the state. That's a terrible state to get yourself into.
Agnes lifted her hands to her face. Her head was sore, her arms were sore, and her body felt like it was bruised all over.
Well now, I hate to see you suffer.
Jinty looked at her out of the side of her eyes and sniffed.
I don't suppose you have any in, do you?
Agnes knew that Jinty already knew the answer from her search of the kitchen cabinets.
I think there is a last can under the kitchen sink and a bag behind the bleach.
Her head was swimming. Jinty sniffed.
Do we have a wee taste? You know, just to get you right.
Agnes nodded And Jinty, with creaking knees, sprang from the settee and near skipped through to the kitchen. She found the can as easily as Agnes knew she would, and returned with it and two rinsed out tea mugs. She put the mugs on the table, and with a little finger, pulled the ring on the special brew. The can bubbled foam as she expertly poured half in each of the mugs. She took a white finger and ran it around the lip of the empty can, and then popped it in her mouth as though it were whipped cream.
"Oh, that's nice,"
she moaned quietly.
"I suppose we could just skip the tea and have this."
Her eyes slid to the side.
"I wouldn't be doing this, mind, but you look like you're in a right state, and I hate to see any of God's creatures suffer."
As if it were a Dolly's tea party, Jinty lifted a mug with two little hands and offered it to Agnes. Agnes took the mug, put it to her mouth, and took a small sip. The bulk groaned inside her. She took another, and out of habit, set the mug down on the far side of the chair, hidden in secret. Jinty lifted her mug and took a mouse's mouthful. She made a happy sound, and took another, and then another. The two women didn't speak again until the mugs were almost drained. Agnes felt the lager push the bulk back into her belly. The shaking in her bones grew quieter. She ran a hand over her tender thighs and started to feel angry. Sipping away, Jinty could see the empty bottom in sight.
"Aye, well, I can't stop long."
She took out her hanky and wiped her lipstick off the edge of the empty mug.
"Would another wee one make you feel any better?"
she sniffed. Agnes nodded feebly. Jinty's scheming eyes narrowed.
"I didn't see any more under that sink of yours. You've no got another secret planking place, have you?"
Agnes thought about the usual places. Behind the immersion heater, the top of the tallest wardrobe. She shook her head.
"Och, well, I can't stay anyway,"
said Jinty, sadly. The fine lines around her mouth pinched.
"But just look at you. You look like you might die if I left you now. Do you have a couple of pounds, maybe? I suppose I could run up to the wee shop."
Agnes reached down the side of the seat and took out her purse. It was empty but for chewing gum wrappers. Her mind went to the driver and the taxi in the dark pit, and she felt the bile rise in her again.
"No even a wee bit left from your Tuesday book, hen?"
asked Jinty sadly. Agnes shook her head. Jinty McGlinchey shifted nervously in her seat, like she had the itchy piles. She looked at Agnes and looked at the empty mug. Finally, she sighed, and then she sniffed.
"Well, let me see what's in my purse."
With a heave, the tiny boned woman lifted her big leather bag off the floor. She sat it on her small lap and almost climbed in it. Agnes heard keys and coins moving around at the bottom. And then there was a sweet watery thud as Jinty drew out three cans of warm Carlsberg.
"You can pay me later."
Jinty opened a can and repeated the delicate pouring and the waiting and the licking of the foam from her small white finger. Only when they were starting the third can did they start to feel like themselves again.
"I was at my daughter's last night. You should have seen the state of that house."
Jinty wiped the end of her nose with her old hanky.
"I look after an idle bastard with a rotten liver, and I can still keep a clean house." "How is the new baby?"
asked Agnes, only half interested.
"Aye, fine, I suppose. She loves the thing as much as you could,"
Jinty said dispassionately.
"She'll get more of the benefits now, of course. I tell her she should set a little aside and hire a cleaner. Filthy. Honestly, I look at her sometimes and I don't know what I've raised."
Jinty was getting worked up.
There was dust that thick in her skirn board. She looked to me as if to say, Mammy, can you no help? And I just turned to her and said, I have raised my children. I am done.
The woman made a cutting motion in the air. Agnes nodded, sadly. She would have loved a house full of grandchildren. She would have loved a house to be full again of her own children. Jinty went on.
Chellion's eldest called me Granny the other day. I nearly had its wee tongue out. I wouldn't mind, but his other granny makes him call her Shirley, so I wasn't going to be the only old bitch at Christmas.
She picked up her drink and studied Agnes over the top of her mug.
Here, what are you so quiet for?
Me? Asked Agnes.
Nothing. Agnes, I might be a lush, but you are a bloody liar.
The women sat in silence and tanked the rest of the can. Eventually, Agnes asked quietly,
Jinty, if I tell you something, would you keep it between us and not tell a soul?
The woman's eyes shone like beads. She crossed her heart with a finger, except she missed and crossed the wrong side.
All my life, I had a bad blackout last night.
Agnes then told Jinty the story of the bingo and the taxi and the driver pulling over into the pit mouth. She lifted the sleeve on her jumper and showed Jinty the finger marks the rapist had left in her white skin. The little woman tutted and shook her curly head.
Bad bastard. To do that to a defenceless woman? What is this world coming to? The way people take advantage of each other. That wouldn't have happened in our day. They would have caught the swine and ridden him through the trongay on a fence.
With a knuckly finger, she motioned the sharp fence rail going right up the man's arse. Jinty took her hanky out and wiped her nose. Then she took it and wiped the shop dust from the top of the last can. The women looked at it mournfully.
Is there no way you could get a couple of pounds?
Agnes watched the last of the golden liquid pour into the mugs. In her mind, she shook the telemeter, the gas meter and the electric meter, and they were all empty.
No,
she said sadly.
Is there one of your men friends you could phone?
Agnes thought about the bruises on her body.
No.
Jinty sat quiet for a minute, savouring the last of the golden liquid.
How about giving that fellow a phone?
She asked.
You know, the wee fellow with all the long hair in the back.
She mimed the curly mullet that was popular with footballers and pop stars.
I heard he's no sure of a bob or two, and that he likes a good drink.
Who?
Jinty thought for a moment.
Lambie. Aye, that's it. We could give him a phone.
The cousins of Pithead told everyone that Ian Lambert was a coal miner whose wife had left him high and dry just before the closing mine delivered the final blow. With no woman to spend the pitiful severance on, he had kept it hidden under his bed. When the other miners drank it away or used it to feed and clothe their growing broods, Lambie still sat in his nest egg and went out and got a part-time job repairing rented tellies. The cousin said Lambie was a lonely and dull man who was not made for the romance novels. He had got himself a trendy footballer's mullet, but still looked like an undernourished teenager. Despite his being nothing in the looks department, these same women brought him plates of burnt potatoes with grey meat and bowls of frozen broth. The cousins said he was a good man who kept himself to himself, and that after the mine shut, he proved himself to be a worker still. They fed him bits of leftovers, knowing that his pit severance could have fed their wains for a year or more. Jinty chimed in again.
We could have a wee party, just the three of us.
Agnes looked at the emptying mug and felt the panic rise. She nodded. Jinty was up on her quick feet like a startled cat. She pulled the phone book from the vinyl telephone table and, licking her little fingers, flicked till she came across the L's. She read aloud.
L. L. Lambert. Mr. C.
Jinty checked the address and, sure it was Lambie, went and dialed his number. She cleared her throat as the phone rang. It was lunchtime on a Thursday, but a man's voice came on the phone.
Oh, hello, Lambie,
she said in her best accent.
It's wee Jinty here. Aye, that's right. I live on the other side of the scheme. You'll know my John. I used to go around with Mary McClure. Aye, that's right.
She paused.
Mary? She got into a terrible state in the valley, am I? I know. It's a right shame. She was a lovely lassie as well. Last time I heard she was working Blythewood. Aye, well, but for the grace of God, eh? But you know, there is a big difference between enjoying a quiet drink and selling yourself for a prescription, don't you think? Sad it is. I was there when she started that Valium nonsense. Aye, awful it was.
Jinty sniffed.
Anyway, I was just giving you a wee phone because I wanted to see if you wanted to stop by my pal's house for a wee drink.
She paused.
Aye, it's a bit early it is. It's just she's a lovely lassie, and I've been dying for the pair of you to meet. Aye, Agnes Bain. Aye, that's right. Puts you right in mind of Liz Taylor. Bit paler, though.
Jinty smiled excitedly into the living room. She motioned for Agnes to paint her face.
So will you come? Good. Lambie, I hate to ask. Do you think you could be a real pal and bring a wee carry out with you? Aye. We're a wee bit short. Aye, she is lovely. Keeps herself immaculate, smart talking. Aye, we'll have a wee party. Just bring 6 cans and a wee half bottle. Oh, and then whatever you would like to drink for yourself. Remember, it's a house near the corner.
Jinty finished the phone call and told Agnes he said he would be there in the hour. She started tidying up the empty fag packets and ring pulls.
You know, Hen, if I were you, I might run a wee brush through my hair, cover the bruises, try and make yourself look a bit more appetising.
They waited over an hour on frayed nerves until Lambie arrived. Jinty showed him in. He sat on the edge of the settee and fidgeted with his trendy bomber jacket like a teenager. Agnes could see that everything the scheme had said about him was true. Jinty made the introductions and slipped the heavy plastic bag out of his hand. Nice to meet you, Agnes, he said, through a row of neat teeth. Agnes mustered as much of her charm as she could.
It was nice of you to come visit with us. It's hard to make your own fun in this desolate place.
Aye, well, isn't every day a fella like me gets an offer from 2 beautiful women such as yourselves?
Lambie said. Jinty squealed with filthy delight. Agnes had heard better patter. She sat back in the armchair.
So, you are not related then? She asked. I don't think I've yet to meet someone from this scheme who is not tied right back to Jinty by blood or marriage or wains.
No, I think my ex-wife had something to do with the McAvennies. I'm an O'Hara. We tend to live over on the burn side of the scheme, in the flat-roofed houses.
It's a wonder some of the Waynes develop bones at all.
Lambie smiled kindly at the insult.
Aye, well, that's probably why you've been the talk of the town, fresh blood and all.
Jinty took a half bottle of Smirnoff from the bag and poured a big finger into each of the 3 mugs. On top of the vodka, she poured in some bright, fizzy iron brew. It bubbled and hissed and looked as innocent as ginger ale.
Oh, I can't stop long,
she sniffed to herself, taking a big mouthful. Lambie smoked rollies, and he sprinkled the paper with tobacco and ran his pink tongue along the sticky edge.
Besides, I've seen you afore, he said to Agnes. Always thought you must have had a man, looking as well as you do.
He He licked the first cigarette closed and passed it to Jinty.
It doesn't cost to take pride.
She's a happy divorcee, interrupted Jinty.
She's a lucky one.
Any woman can do fine with that fat sack of meat storing next to her every night. Isn't that right, Hen?
Spoken like a true woman, said Lambie.
Agnes thought how he looked too young to know what a true woman was, but said nothing. She took a long mouthful from the muck. The vodka tasted clean, like bleach. Lambie licked the next cigarette very slowly. Agnes saw that his nails were very clean and his ears and neck looked flushed pink, as though he had just taken a hot bath.
I mean, come on. There has to be something men are still good for, he said lasciviously.
This tickled Jinty. She swung her little legs and cackled like a girl.
Absolutely bloody nothing, she squealed. Agnes! Do you hear the cheek of this filthy wee bugger? He thinks we were born yesterday.
The heat of the vodka brought out a split vein sanguine in her cheeks.
Have you been seeing anyone lately, Lambie?
Aye, couple of birds, he said, looking at Agnes. I'm playing the field, trying to keep it casual-like.
He gave her a wink.
Ach, men are all the bloody same, eh, Agnes? Even as babes, they lie on their backs, fascinated by their little thingy.
How about you? He asked Agnes. Have you been seeing anybody?
Jinty rolled her knees in an excited circle and answered for Agnes.
Huh?
She squealed.
That one is practically on call for the Greater Glasgow taxi livery.
Agnes felt the sting of the words push into the bruises on her body. She lifted her mug anyway and nodded a sad acceptance of the award. Jinty pulled the plastic bag from between her small feet and added cruelly,
If you're not a taxi driver, then this one's not interested.
Is that right? Said Lambie.
He looked at Agnes directly again and with a hurt frown asked,
How's it working out for you?
Jinty interrupted again.
It's not a choice she can help. It's a curse.
She hears the thrum of a diesel engine and it snickers off a whoosh. The meter's running.
The room got colder. There was a slow sucking in of air and Agnes's face hardened to glass. The drink soaked into her now and the words escaped her in a low, threatening hiss. You are one low, backstabbing little cunt, Jinty McGlinchey. The little shrew stopped her mindless laughing.
Ugh, calm yourself. I didn't mean anything by it.
She greedily tipped the mug to her face, but her little eyes were sharp daggers peering over the top of it. Lambie stiffened, looking from one woman to the other. The room was silent.
Look, maybe I should head, eh?
Jinty crossed her ankles demurely over the bag of carry-out and shushed him.
Oh, don't mind her. She was just a bit unlucky in love last night. You have to stay. You have to help and cheer her up, eh?
Agnes sat quietly for the rest of the afternoon, drinking whatever Jinty put in front of her and smoking whatever Lambie rolled. He tried to talk to her about all sorts of things, but when she got the chance to answer for herself, she could only manage a yes or no. By the time they were well into the cans, Jinty had seen enough.
Lambie, son, I don't know what's going into her,
she moaned sourly.
She's normally the life and the soul.
That's all right.
His cheeks were flushed the same red as Jinty's, and he still sat in his nylon bomber jacket. Agnes thought he must have been uncomfortable. She wondered whether he was embarrassed because he had no one at home to iron him a clean shirt.
Aye, but I don't want you leaving here thinking you've spent the day at the old folks' home. Put one of these tapes in, would you? We'll have a wee party.
Lambie reached over and opened Lizzie's old stereo unit. He lifted one of the tapes from a pile and slipped it in the player.
My wife used to like this, he said, mostly to himself.
What a voice that woman has. What
a voice, said Jinty between draws. She twirled her small white hands in the air to the melody.
Lambie, for God's sake, would you get that miserable sod up?
He eyed Agnes nervously.
No, leave her be. She doesn't want to dance.
After a quarter bottle and six lagers, he was feeling only slightly less timid.
Lady Bean,
Jinty scolded like a headmistress.
This is a party. This man has brought us drink. Now give him a dance.
Agnes looked at Lambie, as itchy as a young lad at a school disco. She gave him the best half-smile she could manage to let him know it was all right. On uncertain legs, Lambie rose to his feet. He took her hands and tried to tug her from the chair the way plumbers pull a stubborn clog out of a drain. Agnes hadn't stood since she had sat in that chair earlier. The drink and the inertia made her legs go soft, and as she rose, he caught her in his arms as if they had been lovers for a long time.
There you go, eh?
Squealed Jinty, pouring herself a sly top-up behind their backs.
Keep a good hold of her.
The two of them did a sort of end-of-the-night dance, a clumsy waltz, old-fashioned and slow. They held each other up purely by the way their sweaty bodies were mashed together. Agnes's face was inches from his, and for the first time she noticed that he had shaved for their little party. His neck was covered in sore goose flesh, and there was a smell of pine about him, from the kind of aftershave that smelled like bathroom cleaner. Not a trace of sex in it.
You're a great wee dancer,
he spoke to her kindly. She tried to be attentive and listen, but only her body was in the room. Jinty drank the mug dry.
Give him a wee kiss.
I haven't been up at the dancing since my divorce came through, he said.
Don't be ungrateful. He bought you all that drink. Kiss him,
said Jinny. Maybe I could take you one night.
He'll no be back,
Jinty warned. Agnes was nearly 2 inches taller than the younger man. With their age difference, it could almost have been her own leek she was dancing with. She saw now the far side of his face had a knife scar running from ear to chin. A common enough chib mark. But on such a young man, it seemed a shame. With a clumsy hand, she reached out and touched it.
Ah, so you noticed that, did you?
He said, shyly.
You look like my eldest boy.
Give him a wee kiss, for God's sake,
squealed Jinty, cracking another can. Agnes let her hand linger on the young man's face and thought how she missed her eldest boy. Even when he was there in the room, she missed him. He had the way of always leaving her feeling lonely. Lambie, this man, put his hand to her face and his lips on her mouth. Jinty crowed with delight. Agnes felt his lips open, felt him suck, felt his tongue probing there. His hand slipped lower down her back.
Now, don't you two do anything I'll have to confess for?
Jinty McGlinchey was fanning herself giddily, relieved to have earned her carry-out. The hands that had been gentlemanly started the sly creep across her arse. With kneading fingers, he pressed the bruise she had earned at the top of her tailbone. The bulk rose in her. She turned her head, but it was too late. She vomited the sour contents of lager and vodka and iron brew down the front of his trendy jacket.
Oh, for fuck's sake!
Screamed the man, dripping in the watery bile.
Mammy?
Shuggy stood in the doorway. Agnes fell back into the seat and put her face into her hands as the hot, drunk tears started to burn out of her. The man looked from the broken lady to the little boy in his school clothes to the woman tucking the last of the plastic bag into her big leather handbag. As he pushed past Shuggy, Jinty shouted down the hallway after him.
Lambie, son, she's no usually like this. I'll give you a wee phone another day and we can have another little party.
The little woman sighed as the front door shut with a slam, and then she looked into all the open fag packets on the table, consolidated them into one packet, and slipped this into her bag. The woman shook each of the open cans on the table, and when she heard the swoosh of remains, she poured it into her mug until she had emptied them all. Jinted down the mug in two or three big mouthfuls, and then she drew her floral scarf out of her bag again.
Right, I can't stop long.
Chapter 18. Shuggy stood as far away from the bladder ball as he could. When it rumbled across the playground, he made a show of running towards it, but was careful to always let the other boys beat him there. He was happier to stand in the shade of the goal corner and watch the girls play a line of skipping elastics, the best of them twisting gracefully down the rainbow-coloured lengths. There was a damp bursting sound in his left ear. The bladder caught him unawares on the side of the face. It stung like the flat of a hand. The ball rolled to the feet of the opposite team, who sent it into the goal. Francis McAvenny stopped at Shuggy's sight. As he was the eldest McAvenny, the trouble between Colleen and Big Jamesy had the deepest repercussions for him. Their promotion to Man of the House was instant, and he found himself caring for his siblings as Colleen numbed herself on Bridie's blue pills. He leaned over as close as he could, so close that Shuggy could feel the shower of his warm spittle.
For fuck's sake, stop being such a poofy wee bastard.
The other boys gathered round like pit dogs, their eyes greedy.
Do you want to be a girl?
Francis grinned, his arms wide for the crowd. Shuggy shook his head. He only wanted to put his hand to the welt in his face.
Would you rather put on a wee skirt?
I don't,
mumbled Shuggy.
Don't talk back to me, Pifter!
Francis, a clear foot taller than Shuggy, pushed him in the chest.
You're a poofy little fairy. You and Father Barry are going to burn in hell for the things you do.
There was a chorus of giggles. Then the laughter changed to a chanting chorus of,
Hit him, hit him, hit him!
Francis lifted his left hand to slap the red side of Shuggy's face. The boy flinched to the other side, but Francis stopped short, and with his other hand made a fist and crashed it into Shuggy's temple. He turned to the cheering boys.
My dad calls out the rat catcher.
Shuggy lay on the ground with his head ringing on both sides. A pair of bare legs with slack white socks appeared over him. The girl was spitting like a cat, her long hair making a stream of frothing lemonade.
Stop it, Francis, you fucking bully! Go ahead and try that shite on me and I'll get you battered. I've got plenty more cousins than you have.
The girl whirled on her heels to tend to him. Shuggy could see the boys give her the finger behind her back, but they were stepping away regardless. There were scabs on her bare knees, and Shuggy couldn't stop looking at the burst elastic of her socks. As she put a hand under each of his armpits and hoisted him to his feet, he could see the floral gusset of her underpants from underneath her skirt.
You should hit him back, she said. I bet if you hit him the once, he'd no pick on you again.
Shuggy didn't know which side of his face to rub at first.
Do you want to cry?
Asked the girl. Shuggy nodded.
Well, don't yet. Hold it in until we're round the corner, and then you can cry. I won't tell.
She led him out of the playground as the boys climbed the railings to spit on them.
You two away to play dollies,
said a ginger-headed boy. The girl was on the fence in a flash. She grabbed the boy's school tie and pulled his face into the thick metal railings. There was a clang as his bony forehead rang off the rusting iron.
Run!
Squealed the girl. They left a cloud in the dust, and there was no stopping until they were halfway up the side of the low hill to Pithead. When they caught their breath, the lemonade-haired girl started roaring with laughter. There was a pinky finger space in the middle of her front teeth. She had a line of freckles across her nose, and her eyes were as shiny and blue as a cat's eye marble.
"Do you really have enough cousins to fight the McAvennies?"
he asked, still trying not to cry. She shook her head.
"No, it's just me and my dad. He'd fight you for the telly remote, but that's about it."
She shrugged.
"I'm Annie. I'm the year above you."
"Oh, I've never seen you before."
"I've seen you. Everybody's seen you."
Annie pointed to the top of the hill, where a makeshift cul-de-sac of mobile homes had been set up.
"We live in the caravans. I'll walk you home. They'll dare not touch you when I'm here."
She puffed out her thin chest.
"Where do you live?"
Shuggy made to point along the low miners' houses and then lowered his hand. She would be drunk. She would be on the phone to the taxi rank raging for his father.
"I don't want to go home just yet."
"It's Thursday," Annie said sagely. "Surely all the drink money is spent by now."
Shuggy squinted at the girl.
"How do you know that?"
She hooked her hand over his arm.
"I've met her once, your ma. She was sat in our settee one day after school. I've never heard a person talk so nice before."
"I really hope she was no bother."
"No, not at all. She smelt lovely. She showed me how to put a French plait in my hair."
Her face darkened.
"I just feel angry for the bad things they say about her. You should fight for her."
"I do fight for her," he said. "Mostly with herself, but it's still a fight."
The girl made a rasping noise of resignation.
"I just let him get the fuck on with it. If my daddy wants to drink himself to death, that's his business. He's lost, I think. He misses my ma."
"Is she dead?"
"Aye, sort of. She lives in Cambuslang with my wee brothers and a semi-professional football player."
They walked to the field that held the caravan cluster.
"But really, you two should fight back. I've heard people say she has a right here for the drink, that you need a daddy and it's her fault you are the way you are."
The girl looked wistful then.
"But I've never met a more beautiful lady. I'd be right proud if she was my ma."
The 12 caravans made a neat semicircle, and someone had lined the uneven mud path with heavy field boulders. Every manner of personal belongings poured out of the tin homes. The path was littered with plastic toys and sodden furniture. The immodesty of it shocked Shuggy. Annie stepped up two breeze blocks to a beige-coloured caravan. A large brown German shepherd lay across the open doorway. Shuggy cautiously followed her inside, stepping carefully around the watchful dog and holding his school bag to his chest. The caravan was narrow and long, the kitchenette in the centre and a horseshoe dinette at the far end. There was a colour television hanging from a bracket in the ceiling. It was blaring the horse racing results in a fast, shorthand voice. The shallow sink was heaped with dirty plastic dishes. Shuggy watched some ants weave industriously among spilt cornflakes.
"Da, it's me," said Annie.
Shuggy could barely see the man sitting in the darkened dinette. He was hunched over the day's paper, running a biro pen under the name of horses.
"Have you eaten anything?"
she asked.
"I could make you a bowl of cereal. I can even eat the milk if you want."
The man with the rheumy eyes didn't answer. Shuggy watched him drink from an old tea mug and go back to scoring the horse races. He tried not to picture his mother here. At the back of the caravan, Annie opened a thin door and pushed the boy through. The bedroom was a pink palace. There were two single beds crammed in the neat space. On each was a Disney princess blanket, and around the walls were thin shelves, each housing a dozen bright rainbow ponies. The room was immaculately clean.
"I'm sorry about the mess," said Annie, sinking onto
the 3 feet of pink carpet between the beds.
"I tried to keep on top of it,
but it's hard when he's that determined to sit in his own filth all day.
She patted the floor beside her, and Shuggy squeezed down into the tight space.
What does your ma do on the drink? Does she mong out like that?
No, she gets very drunk and then she gets very angry, he said. I worry that she'll hurt herself.
Like, do herself in?
I suppose. Sometimes before school I hide all the pills in the bathroom. I know my brother takes his razors to work every day.
He twisted his finger through a loop of pink carpet.
But most of the time I just worry that she will make it worse for herself. She loses her pride. People don't really want to know her anymore. My sister lives with black people a million miles away because of her. My big brother is trying to save enough money to leave.
Annie reached under the bed and opened an old colouring book. He was disappointed to see that she had matched the colours well enough, but that she hadn't stayed in the lines.
When the mine closed, I had to stay here to look after my da, said Annie. My old ma didn't gie two hoots.
She flicked through the pages.
Do you want to do some colouring in?
She asked abruptly. Shuggy shook his head. His eyes couldn't help but flit to the shelves of rainbow-coloured ponies looking down happily on them.
Do you want to play with my horses?
Asked Annie. She was watching him closely, but he shook his head and tried to look disinterested.
My ma sends me them at Christmas and Easter. Sometimes she keeps sending the exact same one. That's how I know she's not paying any attention.
Annie bounced up on one of the thin beds.
Here, your ma plaited this one's hair for me.
She handed Shuggy a raspberry pink horse. It had a long purple plastic mane and tail, both of which had been plaited neatly and finished in a bow made out of a plastic loaf tack. Annie gathered a handful of other ponies and bounced down off the bed and back to the caravan floor. They were all kinds of coloured plastic, each painted with long eyelashes and cheerful smiles.
You be butterscotch, corn candy and blossom. I'll be Bluebell, all cause she's my favourite. The others want to steal her pretty hair clips, but she's too fast.
The plastic ponies looked like puffy dog toys, but to Shuggy, they were magical. Annie let him play with the ponies for the whole afternoon. They talked in high, animated voices, racing them across the face of the bedspread. They ran tiny brushes down their manes until the plastic hair shone with static. Eventually, Annie grew bored by the ponies. She seemed restless, then itchy. Her thin arms searched the darkness beneath her bed. From underneath the flounced pink ruffles, she pulled out an oyster shell ashtray heaped with cigarette ash. There were two or three half-smoked doubts embedded in the ash. Annie pushed open the caravan window, she lit a crooked cigarette, took a shallow puff, and blew the smoke through the crack. She inclined her head in the direction of her father.
Sorry, he gets my nerves up that bad.
She offered the damp doubt to Shuggy. He pursed his mouth and shook his head primly. Annie shrugged and slid back to the floor with a bump, the cigarette clamped tightly between her teeth. Shuggy was making cotton candy chase Bluebell over a cassette tape gymkhana when Annie asked abruptly,
Shuggy, have you really touched Johnny Bell's wee man?
The sore sides of his face flushed red again as he remembered Bonnie Johnny, the washing machine boy. Suddenly, he wanted to drop the girl's toys, push them away from him like they were evidence of the dirty things he had done.
No,
he lied.
What was it like?
She asked, regardless. The cigarette was hanging from the corner of her mouth as she covered the pony's flank in star-shaped stickers. She did it all with an air of routine and boredom, lethargic as any unionized workie.
I said I never.
Her left eye was shut tight against the sting of rising smoke.
Well, I would say I never too, but I've touched a wee man before. I've touched the O'Heaney boys and Fran Buchanan's.
But you are only 9, said Shuggy.
He sat away from the ponies.